Welcome to Inside the Treehouse, a conversation with world-class K-12 education experts who will talk about their personal journey and all things education. I'm Jeff Jones, and our podcast is brought to you by Solution Tree, the home of some of the greatest tested and proven solutions to problems we face daily in K-12 education. And today I'm going to be interviewing Dr. Anthony Muhammad, whom I guess we've known each other now for 20-some years, I would imagine.
Let's say 2003.
Is that the first institute?
Yeah, so first institute I presented.
Yeah.
So like 17 years.
Wow. Wow, that's a pretty good run.
Yeah. Yeah.
So let's start before that. So tell me about Anthony growing up. You grew up in Flint, Michigan, right?
Mm-hmm.
The booming part of the country, the epicenter for General Motors.
Exactly. It's actually the birthplace of General Motors. So if you Google it, put in GM birthplace, Flint, Michigan pops up. There's actually an historical marker on Court Street where the first General Motors office was housed. And it was a wonderful place to grow up. It was a refuge for a lot of folks from the South who opportunities were waning and the agricultural industry wasn't quite as friendly. A lot of people were into sharecropping, stayed in debt, and the carpetbaggers would go South. And as the plants were being built in the North, it was attractive to leave all that debt and the backbreaking work of agricultural work to come North and earn a middle-class wage, often without even a high school diploma.
Yeah.
So you imagine what people, first-generation middle-class, hardworking, good UAW wages, schools well-funded, unemployment almost unheard of, great community programs, and to witness that as deindustrialization took place, start to unravel, it's almost unrecognizable today
from
what it's a true ghost town.
Yeah, it had a lot of trouble. It's been in the news too much
the
last several years.
And when you rip 90% of an industry away,
right,
it makes it difficult.
But your mom wasn't part of that.
No. She was a beneficiary because obviously General Motors was big with paying taxes and the people who lived there, were employed by General Motors, paid good taxes to fund the school. My mother was a teacher.
Right.
And first generation in her family to go to college. And she taught in high schools. And my mother was a stickler for expecting excellence. And she had a standard that we had to meet. And she wasn't a malicious or mean kind of person, but you didn't want to disappoint her.
Right.
Because she had very high expectations. And I remember many of my friends getting money for grades. And she said, well, that's your job. And it was just an expectation.
Right.
And it wasn't whether you're going to go to college, it's what college you're going to go to. It wasn't getting good grades. It was just, it's an expectation. A C was considered an F. And the school's standard for athletic eligibility was a 2.0.
Okay.
Mine was a 3.2.
Is that right?
Yeah. So she kind of married my love of sports with achieving in the classroom. And I do want to kind of backtrack on achievement. I don't think I was really a high achiever. As Rick DeFore often points out, schools took them a long time to become learning focused.
Right.
I was compliant.
Okay.
And I did what was required. So they said, put your name in the upper right-hand corner with the date and the assignment number.
Right.
I did it. Turn your term paper in on this date with the stapled in the upper left-hand corner. I did it. So I understood, I think Doug Reeves calls it schoolsmanship.
Okay.
I knew how to do what the teachers required. And there was some learning that took place, but very different than what we call a learning community today. Competency-based, outcomes-based.
Sure.
It was compliance and meeting the demands of school and the teachers. I did that. I was very good at that. But that covered some gaps that I had academically, particularly in mathematics. I remember my math teacher in high school calling us to his desk and asking us, Algebra 2, what grade do we think we deserved?
And?
Being a capitalist I am, said an A+. He didn't teach a lick of algebra. Then we matriculate to senior year. We have trig, and I had no algebra 2. Dropped it because I'd met my math requirement. Went on to college, placed in college algebra, and I hadn't had a real math class since my sophomore year of high school. All of the STEM opportunities were closed to me. with a 3.8 GPA.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So I'm kind of a living example of parental expectations, kind of guiding schoolsmanship, but missing some of the gaps that may develop because grades don't always mean that you've learned a lot.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like the drive for your mother had to have you have the right grades.
Yeah.
Didn't fall too far from the tree when you're raising your own kids.
Yeah.
Difference is you knew how to cover those gaps when your kids are going through school.
And as a professional educator myself who was introduced to what it means to have learning guide your practice, look for different things with my kids. My mother did a great job and I wouldn't change anything. It was more the system's response.
Right.
We were assessed on our compliance and our assimilation more than the actual demonstration of knowledge. And there was a price to pay for that.
So did you go to, you went to Michigan State, ran track, and did you go there to be a teacher when you first went?
I went there with the goal in mind to be an accountant.
Really?
When I was in high school, the only teacher that really, I had a few, but the teacher that inspired me most was my accountant teacher. She just was, had good relationships. And she made accounting interesting.
Right.
And something that we can really connect with. And I actually won a citywide contest. Baker College, which is like a trade school.
In Flint?
In Flint. Yeah. There's several across the Midwest.
Right.
They would have a high school like vocational competition. And they had an accounting competition. I won. It was a test. Number one in the city. So I thought I was hot stuff. But then I went to college and there was a series of advanced math classes that I had to take to actually be admitted into the College of Business to be an accounting major.
Right.
And I couldn't get past the math classes. So that ended up being a blessing because it kind of steered me in education.
Right.
But that should have been a choice that I could have made, not because of being ill-prepared.
But it sounds like that accounting teacher serve two purposes. One, your love for accounting, which you thought you were going to do, and then to become a teacher.
Yeah.
Everybody's got their favorite teacher, right?
Yeah.
Back in high school or middle school.
Yeah. I ended up getting her because I didn't fill out my electives form. And I was placed there by the counselor because I didn't fill out my elective sheet. So they just put me in accounting.
Wow.
Ended up taking it for 3 years.
Stroke of good luck there.
Yeah. But I said, I wish it would have been a choice to choose education. I was pushed into the non-STEM related fields because of my gaps in math.
Right. So when you got out of college, let's talk about your early career. Where did you start teaching?
I taught at Rich Middle School in Lansing, Michigan. And Rich was a typical urban middle school, and Magic Johnson went to Rich.
But it wasn't Rich.
No, it wasn't Rich. That was just the name of the person who the school was named after. His name was Dwight Rich.
Okay.
So it's Rich Middle School, the Rich Middle School Bears, and I taught seventh grade social studies, and I loved it. I actually asked the superintendent when I was hired, because believe it or not, I was one of only five black male teachers in Michigan under the age of 25.
In the whole state?
That was back in 1991.
Wow.
I was one of five.
Wow.
And so I had my pick. I mean, I was like a unicorn. I could go anywhere I wanted. But I chose Lansing because I went to school in East Lansing. So it was just an easy transition. And I asked the superintendent, because he talked to all of the people that were new hires. I said, put me in the toughest place you have. Because I had this theory that the friends that I grew up with who fell through the cracks because they didn't play schoolsmanship, they were underserved by the system. And if they got better service, you'd get a different outcome. If the schools were better, the kids would have a better experience. So I didn't want to go to a place that all was already considered a good school.
Right.
Wanted to go to the place that people thought was the worst school in the city. And I was secondary certified, so I couldn't go to elementary. I loved middle school. I did my student teaching in the middle school, so that was kind of my niche. And
not a lot of people asked to go to the worst school in the city.
And I did that because I knew those kids were just like me. And the friends that I grew up with, who their parents thought that General Motors was going to be there for them forever. So school wasn't seen as a means to social mobility.
Right.
School was a place you hung out until you dropped out and worked at GM, you worked at Chevy or Oldsmobile or Fisher Body. But we got this big surprise of deindustrialization and international competition. So the promise of the safety net of industrialization wasn't there for my friends the way their parents were. So you could blame the parents if you like, but they were just, they made the assumption that they say in physics, an object in motion tends to stay in motion.
Right.
They couldn't have anticipated that Toyota, Honda,
Fiat,
the robotics,
right,
engineering and replacing people with robots. They couldn't predict that that was going to happen.
Right.
So my friends were caught ill-prepared, not because they were not smart. The system didn't have any vision of what the future would look like.
Sure.
So we got an industrial education for an industrial town.
Sure.
That was no longer industrial.
It disappeared.
It disappeared.
Yeah.
So my theory was, if I can get to kids early and prove that these are not irredeemable throwaways, that I could do something worthwhile.
So then you moved from there to where? Because then you went into administration.
Yes, I was a reluctant administrator. I loved the classroom. I was in the classroom for 8 years. But as you know, and those listeners may not know, I have a lot of kids.
And how many kids?
Six.
That's right.
And the salary of a teacher just couldn't keep up
right
with my expenses as a father. Harcourt Brace, every year they do a state of the teaching profession. And last year was really focused on why so many teachers leave in a profession. And number one was pay not equal to the level of commitment for the profession. But it's not a new problem. It's been around for a long time.
Well, you and I know that with all the associates that we have. People are looking for other opportunities to supplement their income or to replace their income.
So the problem isn't they're not mission driven.
Right.
If I could have stayed in the classroom and made a living wage, I probably would have done that. So I've been pushed by central office for years to go into administration. And I was asked to go to the school where the principal was great with relationships, but academically and curriculum wise, they weren't very strong. So I became an assistant middle school principal for 2 years.
And that was at Levy?
No, it was at a different school in Lansing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Spent 2 years there. Then I spent some time as a principal for 3 years at a charter school in Lansing.
Okay.
Yes. It was actually my mentor. She was my teacher mentor. She started one of the first charters in the state of Michigan. So she brought me on because a charter is a public school. It's called Public School Academy, which is its own independent district.
Right.
So her official title was superintendent because every official district has to have a superintendent. I was right under her serving as principal. I was there for 3 years, and then I moved from there to Levy Middle School in Southfield.
So you had had quite a career in Lansing before you moved to Levy.
Yeah.
And then when you moved into administration, were there more African-American males getting into the profession?
Not necessarily profession. It was pretty decent representation in administration.
Okay.
If you're kind of a unicorn and you're decent, people look to move you up through the system because there's just so few of you.
Right.
Like I said, I love the classroom, but I kept getting pushed into leadership, and I eventually accepted that challenge. So I didn't find a lack of representation in administration. It was in the ranks of teachers. You just weren't, the system's just not producing enough to replace the people are leaving the classroom and going into administration.
Right.
So I didn't find greater representation among teaching ranks. When I was a principal at Levy, I had 2 African-American male teachers. That's it. Staff of 61.
Wow.
In a school that's 98% African-American. Now I had decent African-American female representation.
Right.
But male, 2.
Out of how many males?
I'd have to go back and look, but just a rough estimate, probably 35%. 30-35%.
Interesting.
So quite a few white male teachers.
So Levy was it a STEM school when you went there? Mm-mm. Was it a STEM school when you left?
No.
Okay. Because it is now.
Yeah, the district has taken on the district is profoundly different now. I left Levy in 2006.
Okay.
Because of deindustrialization, Michigan was the only state in the 2010 census to have lost population between 2000 and 2010. Louisiana did as well, but it was because of Hurricane Katrina.
Sure.
So that was more of an anomaly. We're the only state that people left more than were born.
Okay. So I remember touring Leavey's with you years ago. What year would that have been? When would those have been?
Probably 2003 or four.
Okay.
Maybe five.
And you did some, you kind of got an entrepreneurial spirit in your whole life. You did some pretty entrepreneurial, pretty unique things in Leavey. Yeah. Talk about some of those.
A few of them. One was called the Leavey Dollar Store. I had a teacher who had a business background, but he was a science teacher. And he wanted to lead this extracurricular activity where he would teach kids entrepreneurship and the art of sales. So we were able to produce a board of directors, a mix of business people and students, and produced his school-run store where we got businesses to donate items, and the students would run it during their lunch period. It grew so much that we had to relieve him from his duties as a science teacher, and he became a business ed teacher because he had a dual certification. And we didn't get more staff, so I had to let somebody go who had an elective that wasn't working very well. We had a horrible careers class, and I had to let her go. And she found a job in another school in the district.
Okay.
Yeah, so she wasn't unemployed.
Right.
I had the power of FTE.
Okay.
So I moved him and hired another science teacher. So we created a feeder program where kids who worked in the store had to go through our business program. So sixth grade was all customer service.
Okay.
Focus on customer service. Seventh grade was middle management. Eighth grade was executive management. And he would keep a cohort of kids throughout their experience. And he actually got a salary in what's called Leavey dollars. It's fictitious fiat dollars. The kids act, you can't spend real money in the dollar store. You have to use Leavey dollars. And the teacher can give them to kids or staff member for anything that they do.
Okay.
Kind of collaboration among our noon aides, our cafeteria workers, and assessing our obesity issue, which is huge in the African American community. They produced a Weight Watchers type point-based program that every item in the cafe had a point. Like with Weight Watchers, you get brownies 4 points.
Right.
And at target points. And if kids, if they calculated their points, were below the target points, they got Leavey dollars. And they can go shop. Teachers would use them as incentives for certain things. But the students got a salary who worked in the store. And that salary was developed by the board of directors.
That is really clever.
Yeah, so we had a hip-hop literacy program where a lot of our kids were interested in music.
Right.
So they would produce, perform, edit, and distribute academically based music. And they would give it to teachers as instructional aids. So if it's teachers in eighth grade, Algebra 1 are having an issue with Pythagorean theorem, the kids who took that course would take Pythagorean theorem, make a song about it, perform it, edit it, produce it, distribute it back to the teacher. And they could come after school and produce their own stuff, but it had to be clean.
So that's
you would have kids stay to 8, 9 o'clock at night.
That's one of the programs that that had a real impact on me when I went to the school.
Yeah.
Because those kids were passionate about it.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Wouldn't it be great if you were able to track those kids that went through the business program?
Yeah.
See where they are today and how
it would be great.
Yeah,
it would,
it's tough to do.
Yeah, it's tough.
Really hard to do.
We can't even contract trace people with coronavirus. So it's hard for me to go back to 2004.
No lie.
But I know it didn't do any harm.
Right. Well, that's for sure.
Yeah.
So then how did you get involved with the whole professional learning communities? What's your story there?
Reluctant convert. My superintendent sent out a memo telling all the district administrators that we had to go to Lincolnshire, Illinois to a PLC institute. And I didn't know what that even meant. I was just kind of annoyed that I was losing some of my autonomy with a week of my time. So we boarded school district vans. And if you ever travel in school district vans, they're not luxurious accommodations. Went to Lincolnshire, and I was a reluctant participant. I think there might have been 200 and some odd people.
Okay.
Kind of maybe second or third year.
Yeah, that would have been right.
Yeah, 200 and some people. In an auditorium that seats about 1,000. So I intentionally picked a seat in the back of the auditorium, waiting for an excuse to leave.
It's a good thing it's that populated area. There was no place to go.
There's no place to go. But then the opening keynote came out, and at that point, Rick DeFore did two keynotes.
Mm-hmm.
An opening, and he did another one, because when the institutes were 4 days. And Rick Stiggins was there. Becky DeFore was new. And Bob Baker did one, but Rick DeFore did two. I felt his arguments were so compelling that my reluctance kind of turned into curiosity. Went to breakouts, and some of the faculty members at Stevenson, Gail Kaharnik, and others, they kind of did the breakouts. I think Errol Twaddell.
It was all staff at that point.
Yeah. And I was like, okay, this is, he's not just talking. They've done this stuff. And I got interested in what they call the Pyramid of Interventions, their advisor advisee program. Just, it was just riveting. And by day four, I was a convert. And I approached the late Rick DeFore, one of the architects of the PLC concept, and I asked him, would he help me? And I kind of challenged him. I said, I didn't see any minority representation. You know, is this a white thing? And he hit me with a response that I'll never forget. He said, well, what are you going to do about it? If you're so passionate, you think it's a good idea, you go back and you prove that it works in communities like yours, and I'll give you a platform to share it with others. I was expecting him to just, you know, have a defensive answer. He just flipped it on me.
A lip service.
Yeah. And he was so gracious that he said, he gave me his email address. If you have a question, email me. And we corresponded for that entire year. And we had some really surprisingly good results after just 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
And I emailed him and showed it to him. And he told me that they were doing a conference in Virginia, that they were doing a satellite connection in Milwaukee.
Right.
And would I be willing to do a breakout session and to share what we've done in just a year at Levy in Milwaukee? Because they were streaming the keynotes from Virginia.
We did two of those. Yeah.
And people liked it so much, my little breakout session. And Stubby McLean, who was a former director of Solution Tree Canada, was running that environment, that I was invited to the next institute in Cincinnati. It's kind of a last minute addition.
Yep.
And that's where I got to see Rick again and got a chance to meet you. And that went well. And then this whole kind of connection as a Solution Tree author and consultant kind of was born from that.
So besides being a best-selling author, you're what we refer to at Solution Tree as the trifecta. Because you're not only a great author, you're a great breakout and workshop presenter, but you're a keynoter as well. Not a lot of people can pull off all three of those, especially a lot of people can't be a keynoter and do breakout sessions or vice versa. So then you've expanded upon that, because we've worked together, and with your entrepreneurial spirit, we've started the Culture and Achievement Institutes. Mm-hmm. So talk about your institutes.
Yeah. Well, it's carrying on the legacy of passing it on and building capacity among people, because one of the things that the late Rick DeFore taught me is that the movement has to live beyond you. And if it's a singular movement, then when the movement goes as you go. And the issue of culture became so big that I couldn't do it by myself. So by necessity, I had to start to groom others. And the same formula that worked with me, when Solution was doing two institutes in Virginia and Milwaukee, couldn't split your best people in half.
Right.
You had to find a way to groom new talent. And there are a lot of people who did breakout sessions at institutes that didn't work out.
Oh, yeah.
So these institutes, which Solution Tree so graciously provides its authors, is a place to groom new talent, the superstars of tomorrow, while people are attracted to the face of that movement. So people typically come because they know my work. But what I'm excited about is that there are people who are very talented that just haven't gotten the exposure or haven't been out there very much.
Right.
That they're going to be surprised. The next Mike Mattles.
Right.
The next
Anthony Muhammad.
The next Brian Butler, Luis Cruz, Sarah Shule, that these were diamonds in the rough. And there's so many great folks out there. And the Institute is a great opportunity to get an op to interface with people who have gone through the struggles that you're trying to conquer. So I can produce the framework, give you the research behind culture, some insight from my work. But the breakout sessions, I think, are where people are really going to fall in love. Got Rosa Isaiah, who's a central administrator from Southern California, who has great insight in English language learners and culturally responsive pedagogy. Malik Muhammad, who's from Texas, who is knocking people's socks off when he's working with schools individually. Alex McNeese, who was a teacher of mine at Levy Middle School, Dr. Alex McNeese, who is one of the greatest technical minds on culture. We have a tool called the School Culture Audit. And Dr. McNeese almost embarrasses me because I produced a tool and his audits are so much better than mine because he is a technically inclined person. He's a numbers. He's a quantitative person. And he does a good job of taking abstract ideas like culture and quantifying them. So if all you hear is me, you'll hear my perspective. I'm just really proud that there's a budding group of associates who are adding to the literature.
Well, they don't happen by accident.
Yeah.
I mean, you had a mentor in Rick DeFore and mm-hmm. others, and now you're mentoring others. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we started this whole thing with PLCs 22 years ago. And it's interesting because what you're talking about is the same because Salustri is a PLC.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why our mission statement is advance the work of our authors. It doesn't say advance our authors,
mm-hmm.
advance the work of the authors. Now, I'm sad to say that we proved it true because we lost Rick and Becky and the work mm-hmm. is going on and Bob is not doing as much work as he used to do. But mm-hmm. but you're passing it on. And that's mm-hmm. what Rick did with you and others have done yeah. with you. The mentor that you had in Lansing, Michigan mm-hmm. as well.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
I think we have an obligation. We're only as powerful as the people who paved the way for us. And we want to advance it because when I'm long gone, the need to produce a healthy culture will be there.
Yeah.
But I might not be there physically, but hopefully my contribution lives beyond my physical presence on this earth.
And I have a feeling it will.
Hope so.
Hope that's a long time from now.
Yeah, hope so too. Yeah. I'm not in a hurry to go, but that's one of the things that we're promised when we're born is that right. there will be an expiration date.
Yes. Yeah. All right, so you're always challenging educators to re-examine if they behave in ways that align with their beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
Any words of advice for educators now that they're adapting to a whole new learning environment and they may need to re-examine their behaviors?
Mm-hmm. Well, the need has always been there. I just think that the public attention and the political current has made people pay more attention. Police brutality always existed. Disproportionality with incarceration always existed. So I'd encourage people in this moment of clarity that we take advantage of it. I want to point to the Me Too movement. There were things that I did for years that I had no clue were misogynistic or sexist. I was socialized a certain way with how to interact with women. Well, as women gained a voice, a stronger voice, with the Women's March and then the subsequent Me Too movement, and they started to really address powerful men, I was wise enough to see some of the behavior that other men exhibited, not so much out of fear, but just out of now I'm aware that ways that I thought were okay I behave are not okay. And that women always felt this way, but may not have felt courageous enough or empowered enough to challenge what was clearly misogynistic on my part.
Mm-hmm.
I hope people take the same, and the society's forever changed because of Me Too, and for good reasons.
Yep.
I hope that same impression is left by this new justice movement, that the society will be permanently changed. And people will think twice about things they always did and always saw. But now there's this social clarity around it. People are seeing it through new eyes and that they'll never go back to where they were before.
And we could spend hours on this topic, but it's different than when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
back in the late 60s and early 70s because it was a section of the population mm-hmm. that wanted it to change. Now mm-hmm. we've got generations, cross-generational, that want the change.
And I think that the role of technology and social media has played a big role.
Sure.
It's forced us, because you can't hide, it's forced us to live up to our creed. If you say that it's your unalienable right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, and that's the standard we express to the world. But I got a cell phone camera and I see you violating that. I have an email you sent that violates that. You can't hide from it. Every human being has access to a worldwide network.
It's opaque world.
Yeah. So I believe that I don't think that people were less sincere when you saw the movement in the 60s.
Sure.
It just wasn't the interconnected society that we see today, where you can't hide contradictory behavior.
So I believe right now you've got co-authorship in the works, mm-hmm. if I remember correctly. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Or? The first one is awesome. It's the second edition of the Revisiting PLC at Work, which is really the third edition of the first PLC at Work book.
Right.
If you look at it in a series.
Well, Revisiting is like three books inside one. It was so big.
Yeah. But it was the extension of the original PLC at Work.
Exactly.
And this is an extension of the second. I'm co-authoring with the great Dr. Bob Aker and Mike Maddox. So that rough draft is already done. And now it's in the editing process. And it's, I think it's probably the greatest way of honoring the late Rick DeFore and Becky DeFore.
Yeah.
To add to their work, because the work outlives the person. And this is how they would have wanted it.
Right.
So their voice is preserved while adding the latest insight and information and research about the PLC process so that we're building on it. And my hope is that by the 10th edition, there'll be a new associate today that builds on that and that the literature continues to build on itself. The other project is one that is just in the beginning emphasis stage, along with Doug Reeves, writing about the response to a lot of the call for racial and social equity around student voice and kind of the trauma that they're facing with this pandemic mm-hmm. and with the kind of extrajudicial killings of African-American males in particular, African-Americans as people of color in general, at the hands of law enforcement and just in general, the issue of inequity.
Right.
It's more of a narrative to stimulate student dialogue about the concept so that they can really feel comfortable not letting this momentum die that we've seen recently with the universal acknowledgement that systemic discrimination exists. It's not a myth. And really acknowledging the trauma of people who've had to deal with it their whole life.
That's a big project to undertake.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So you and your bride have six children.
Mm-hmm.
Any of them going to be teachers?
No.
None?
Unfortunately.
Well, your daughter may go to medical school. After she gets out of medical school and practice, maybe she'll go back to teaching medicine.
But no. And it's for those same reasons that the Harcourt Brace report, that if you have a set of academic skills and you have to choose what's the best outlet, what we're requiring of teachers in alignment with what teachers are compensated for, you can't blame young people for making different choices. I hope that what legislators realize, because there's going to be an economic downturn once all this coronavirus dust settles, and that they don't deprioritize education.
Yeah.
Because it's an easy target. It's hard to say, let's cut military, because there's a public sentiment around military. It's hard to say, let's cut Medicare or Medicaid. But we start this narrative that teachers get paid a lot. They get the summers off. Schools aren't performing. That kind of myth that Rick DeFore addressed in Praise of American Teachers.
Right.
If that narrative begins and it's not checked, I would not be shocked if education funding is gutted. It's already gutted enough. If we think we have a teacher shortage now, wait till teachers have 35 kids in a classroom.
Yeah.
with no real cost of living increase. Why would a 19-year-old say, I want to be a part of that? So yep. If it's any legislators who are listening, cutting it, maintaining and increasing education funding, even in an economic crisis, is absolutely critical to national security, economic future, and the security of our society at large.
It's the only way this country is going to get back up on top.
And I fear that legislators who know nothing about education, who start to look at things only through an economic lens, won't see the necessity of education funding. There are so many states now that have alternative certifications. We're putting people in front of kids who spend 24 hours in front of a computer and get a provisional certification. Is that who you want guiding? And bless the people that do it. But we should be incentivizing our best and brightest like Finland does, like Australia does.
Yep.
Pay them to the best of our ability, respect them, and we'll get more people coming and saying, but I want my kids to go in education, but I can't blame them.
But when we were going to school, it was a profession you wanted to go in.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, and you have to thank teachers' unions for a lot of those things. Sure. Now, they did some things that they protected some bad teachers, but teachers' unions made sure that teachers got paid a living wage.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in Southfield, this was back in the early 2000s, the top of our salary scale was $85,000. That's a pretty decent attorney salary.
Yeah.
But we attracted people that didn't have to work at Walmart and drive Uber just to pay their rent.
Yeah.
They could concentrate on teaching. And there's nothing wrong. But somehow politically, we've demonized teachers making good work, the salary. If you pay them well, now you can hold them accountable.
Right.
But if I have to work at Kohl's and Walmart and drive Uber to not be evicted, then don't be mad when I'm not as committed to the profession.
It's a system that's gone awry, and hopefully it won't go worse. It'll get better.
Hope so.
My heart and my head wants it to.
Yeah, we can't drop the ball, though.
Yeah.
I fear the Great Recession of 2008. Education was one of the first things that they started chopping.
Yep.
And it never recovered.
Let's hope history doesn't repeat itself.
Let's hope not.
Thank you for listening to Inside the Treehouse today. If you have an author or a topic to suggest for a future podcast, reach out to me directly at jeff.jones@solutiontree.com. Thank you for listening, and thank you for all that you do.